This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long. Great to have your company today. On this edition, rice diplomacy. For the first time in over 50 years, Pakistan and Bangladesh have started direct government-to-government trade.
It's definitely a huge development for both the countries. We are now witnessing this massive amounts of rice now being supplied by Pakistan.
We'll also take a look at Bahrain. The ratings agency Fitch has downgraded its outlook for the country's long-term debt issuance to negative. We found out why. And what's bothering Paul McCartney?
When we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
Why the former Beatle is worried that the musicians of the future might struggle to pay their bills. But we're going to start the programme talking about AI. There's been plenty of talk about it, of course, in recent years and about how AI is going to take away our jobs. But few companies have actually spelt out what it will mean for them in practice. Well, now one has. DBS, Singapore's biggest bank, says it expects to cut 4,000 roles over the next 3 years because of AI taking on jobs that are currently carried out by humans. It hasn't said exactly what those roles will be, whether they'll be customer-facing, but it's around 10% of the bank's workforce. Josh Kennedy-White is a cybersecurity expert and director of Division X Global, a venture capital firm based in Singapore.
Look, I think 10% is a pretty low number. I would be expecting a much larger number. The transformative effect of this industrial revolution that we're living in right now is like nothing we've ever seen. I mean, it doesn't compare to the steam engine or the mills or anything we've ever seen before. And if you look at banks and what they've been over the years and the opportunity for this technology to be as pervasive as it is, I think the gain is so much higher. I read somewhere the other day that an AI-powered employee is 35 times more efficient than a non-AI-empowered employee. Now, again, 4,000, yeah, sounds like a lot. 10% sounds like a lot. I think it could be a lot more. I think they're probably going to do it through general managed attrition. So people probably won't notice as much of that, but this is the most powerful tool on the market.
And DBS have said that there will be contract workers and freelancers that will be mostly affected by that. Again, do you think this is likely to be the pattern as AI develops?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because, you know, you are embracing a new technology, which is, you know, there's not a huge amount of skills that are out in the workforce. Typically, if you look at other waves of industrial revolutions, whether it's digital transformation or cyber, you know, you typically have a group of people that come in that are currently doing a job and they manage themselves out of roles as they manage technology in. I mean, that's generally how it works. So you would imagine that would happen. This sounds terrible to say, but it's kind of creative destruction. The bank has an obligation to its shareholders to deliver a profitable business. I think the pace of this will be much faster than things we've ever seen. I think that is a concern. And it does pose bigger questions around, you know, what is the role of humans? What are they going to do?
Is the banking sector particularly vulnerable to AI?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Security for AI and AI for security. Banks are heavily regulated industries. Humans are error-prone. They consciously and unconsciously make mistakes. I think that banks are not lean like, say, a retail organisation. They generally have larger workforces because they have regulatory obligations and stiffer penalties, etc. So I think that as a market for deploying a new technology to be able to deliver efficiency savings, there'd be a lot of low-hanging fruit in the bank that there might not be in other sectors like retail.
You spend a lot of your time in Singapore. It's obviously a big financial centre. How worried are people there that AI will take away their jobs?
The truth of it is there's a multi-layer of people that perform jobs, from lower-level workers to perhaps specialist expatriates. I think knowledge workers will be pivoting to where the work is, and consultants will pivot to do the new things in consulting. Nothing ever lasts forever. The ones that I'm worried about is that the pace and scale with this technology has come in is so fast that I don't think it's possible for people to retrain as quickly to be able to become experts in another field. So when I look into a lot of organizations, not just banks, but if I go into any sort of medical organization in Singapore, it's as if I put on these 3D glasses and I look around that I can see the people that won't have jobs in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months.
It sounds like it's the speed of change that you think we should be concerned about rather than the change itself.
I think change is good. I think you need to sometimes break things to make them better. If it's done in a managed way and it's sensitive to people's incomes, and I'm sure DBS has got a plan for this, you know, you've got to remember that this is going to happen over a number of years. There's probably a standard level of attrition within the organisation. I would hope that they can do it in a way that's going to minimise the impact on humans. But we can't just employ people to do mindless tasks that can be done by technology. I just don't think people have really got their head around how transformative this would be. I would get 5 or 6 calls a day asking me a similar question: how do I start this journey? And I think this is the big difference. We've all got access to ChatGPT and Perplexity and other tools, and we know sort of intrinsically that there's 25, 30, 40% efficiency there. We just don't know how to start the journey. I think DBS is just being transparent, actually, about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about AI and the impact on jobs over the last couple of years, but DBS, it seems to me, is one of the first companies to actually put a concrete figure on what AI will mean in terms of job losses for its company. Do you think we're likely to see more of these kind of announcements over the next few months of companies actually putting figures on what AI will mean to them in terms of job losses?
I mean, if they're gutsy and bold and they want to tell their shareholders, then they should. There are organisations like IBM had come out saying how many jobs they were going to get rid of, and then they realised maybe they should think about employee relations before they did that. I'm a DBS customer. If they deployed AI more effectively, they could target me with better offers. They could protect me from phishing attacks. They could do things in real time. There'd be so many other things. So look, as a customer, I would embrace it. And, you know, frankly, if that's going to manifest in better service, lower fees, and you know, just simple things like being able to use a chatbot to be able to get a resolution to an issue, or to say I've received a suspicious email and not be on a call for ages. I think what Push could do has set is a fantastic agenda. People worry about security and AI, and there's a legitimate worry. There's some peculiar forms of attack you can do. But what are we comparing it to? We're comparing it to humans. Humans make a lot of mistakes. So I would rather have things done securely with AI and guardrails around it than not.
Josh Kennedy-White there. So that's one bank and one sector in Singapore. But what about other countries that have built much of their economies around tasks that could potentially be replaced by AI? The Philippines is one such place. My colleague San Fenech has been looking at how AI could disrupt its financial future and how it's trying to prepare. We hear first from Brett Taylor of the AI giant OpenAI.
If you call up a company today and have a phone call, how much do you think that phone call costs for the company? On the order of $10 to $20. Now with AI, that same conversation can cost maybe 10 to 20 cents, or maybe over time 1 to 2 cents.
That's Brett Taylor. He's chair of the board at OpenAI, a prominent research organisation known for developing sophisticated AI models. You might have heard of ChatGPT. Well, they created it.
I think that with every new technology, jobs definitely change. You know, I just look back at moving from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy to a services economy as the economies become more global. Our jobs have all changed. So I think the transition, like any transition, might be uncomfortable, but I'm really excited for the new jobs that will emerge on the other side.
In many sectors, AI is transforming the way we work. Tasks traditionally performed by human employees, like data entry, customer service, and routine processing, are increasingly being managed by AI systems. To understand how AI could change the way outsourcing businesses operate, I spoke to Paul Rivera. Paul has been working in the outsourcing industry in the Philippines for more than 10 years and has recently started working with a small startup business called BridgePath Global Inc.
Right now, AI is helping our business. AI can just enrich everything that we're doing. I think AI is just a tool. It really can't replace people because people need to have emotions, and AI just could not give emotions, especially for customer service. I think the human touch is really needed there.
How is it helping at the moment?
As of now, it's helping us create emails. We're doing cold marketing right now. So it's improving the content of our emails and then having AI generate the email.
So at the moment, AI hasn't cost you any jobs. You haven't thought, oh, that job could be done by AI, so I'm going to lose that person. But could that happen in the future, do you think?
I think it could happen, especially the data entry jobs. It can happen.
Should the people that work in this sector be worried about that?
I think they should, because that's one of the most basic jobs. Data entry jobs require human intervention because they need to distinguish text from images or a lot of data from a table. But if an AI can do it, I think for the data entry jobs, it's going to be obsolete in a few years.
So if AI could take outsourcing jobs away from the Philippines, what will replace them? The Philippine government is actively working to diversify its economy by investing in infrastructure. And one of the most significant investments is the Metro Manila subway station. Here's our reporter, Camille Alemia.
I am here at the subway station being constructed in Quezon City. It is a sunny Saturday morning and it is very busy here. Everyone is working. We see them operating trucks, cranes, and huge bulldozers as they try to lay the groundwork. The entire subway project has an estimated total cost of around $8.3 billion, of which around 80% will be financed through a loan from Japan. Filipinos, including myself, are now eagerly awaiting for its completion, which is targeted in 2029.
The new subway, along with improvements to Manila's main airport and several major bridge and building projects, aims to create jobs, enhance connectivity, and attract more foreign investments. But is it working? Well, according to Minette Navarrete, president of Kickstart Ventures, it is. As the head of a tech venture capital firm that invests in early stage businesses, she certainly knows the landscape well.
It is an exciting time for the Philippines. There have been a number of companies that started out in the Philippines, but have gone on to other countries. But similarly, we see companies, startups from outside the Southeast Asian region coming into the Philippines. And so by building these two-way bridges, we're seeing that we can help take technological advances and new business models to make life and business better.
What is attracting these companies to set up a base in the Philippines?
For many companies, what's attractive is the Philippine demographic. The median age is 25 years old. The United Kingdom's median age is 40. It's slightly younger in the US, 39 years. And so the young population is just entering the workforce. It's more digitally savvy. It feels more socially aware, more globally connected. And all that makes for a base of both consumers as well as talent.
Sam Fenwick there, and you can hear Sam's full report on our sister program, Business Daily. Just search for Business Daily on the BBC website, on BBC Sounds, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm joined by Fiona Sincotta, Senior Market Analyst at City Index. Hi there, Fiona.
Hi.
The AI conversation, I thought it was interesting listening to Josh Kennedy-White in Singapore saying that companies have an obligation to tell both their staff and also shareholders what their plans are and how AI is going to impact them. Are they doing that at the moment? And indeed, can they? I mean, do they know themselves what the impact of AI is going to be?
Yeah, you know, I think we're still very much just on the edge of that discovery still. It feels that we're just sort of getting to an understanding of what AI can start to do for different companies and the broader economy. So I don't think it's really we are there yet where it's possible to say, you know, this is what it can do for each company. We're definitely moving away. The focus has been very much on sort of spending on AI and how expensive and what it's been costing. But I think now we're starting to see that sort of pivot towards what does this mean for other companies? How can the ripple effect improve productivity, reduce costs, and improve sort of target audience? But I just don't think we've got those facts and figures and concrete numbers coming through as clearly as perhaps the bank said that they do at the moment.
Okay, stay with us, Fiona. We'll come back to you later in the program.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. So the Middle East now and the island state of Bahrain, because the international ratings agency Fitch has downgraded its outlook for the country's long-term debt issuance to negative from stable. Fitch says it's worried about Bahrain's high level of debt, high budget deficits and its low foreign currency reserves. Dr. Sara Bazabandi is a Middle East political economist and fellow at the Institute for Security Policy in Germany.
Bahrain is perhaps the smallest economy in the Gulf Cooperation Council. It has very small population and doesn't have as much hydrocarbon resources as some of the rich neighboring countries like Saudi Arabia or Emirates have. It has historically been nevertheless relying on oil revenue and support of the richer neighbors for its government budget. Of course, at some point, Bahraini government tried to push for diversification of the economy. The plan was to turn Manama, the capital of Bahrain, as the center hub for financial sector in the region. But of course, with development of Dubai and Saudi Arabia in more recent years, and of course, Abu Dhabi, that plan has not really been successful.
Okay, and so Fitch has expressed concern about the economy. Just talk us through what those concerns are.
Sure. I think the main concern is that the budget deficit of the Bahraini government has been increasing in consecutive years for a number of years. As a result, the government had to continuously borrow in order to meet its expenditures, and that increased the a very significant and important macroeconomic indicator, that is debt to GDP ratio. And if you look at the data for a number of years, consecutive years, this ratio has been constantly increasing, which means the government of Bahrain has been spending much more than it can earn. And that has really been at the heart of the report by Fitch, and raises the concern for foreign investors, of course, who are Fitch's main audience.
So it's debt that's a concern and the budget deficit. And there have been some warning signs of problems in the economy recently. HSBC recently announced their plans to cease operations in Bahrain. And I believe there was also a joint venture with the Saudis to produce aluminium, which has been called off. So how surprising is this news?
Not surprising given the macroeconomic environment in Bahrain. There is budget deficit issue, there is the huge borrowing issue, and there is also the issue of fiscal discipline, because when a budget deficit to this extent occurs and reoccurs persistently, that's a clear indication that there is lack of financial and fiscal deficit at the senior government level. And of course, this can cause various economic and social destabilizing consequences. And this is something that the foreign investors are very much worried about, and they don't want to really have their assets in an environment with prospective instability. Really.
And what can Bahrain do to resolve some of these problems?
I think diversification of the economy is one issue. They're looking at tightening fiscal discipline, of course, is another issue. They're also looking at cutting some of the government expenditures, for example, the subsidies. In the Gulf region, historically, government subsidies and government perks for the citizens have been a part of the social contract. The governments in that region are the very last absolute monarchy governmental systems around the world, and a key part of the social contract between the monarchs and the ordinary citizens have been through distribution of these incentives, financial incentives and perks. In the case of Bahrain, perhaps the government has gone maybe too far with that. It doesn't mean that they're really well off, but it means that the government continues to distribute perks and incentives beyond its financial means. They're talking about subsidy reform. They're talking about increase of value-added tax. They're talking about introducing corporate income tax. So all of these would probably have, in medium terms, some positive impact on the government budget deficit. But obviously, there is a much more need for fiscal discipline and tightening on government expenditure in other areas beyond subsidies and beyond citizens' support.
Dr. Sarah Bazubandi there. Fiona Sincotta from City Index is still with us. And Fiona, I wanted to ask you about one piece of data which has just come out in the hour before we came on air, US consumer confidence data. What did that show us?
Yes, so quite an interesting reading. It actually came in weaker than expected, falling below sort of 100 to 98.3. That's down quite considerably from the 104.1 level it was at. Now, this is important because a downward trend in consumer confidence can potentially impact consumer spending and economic activity. So consumer spending plays a significant sort of role in the overall economic activity in the US, and a lower reading could mean lower spending. You know, let's just remember last week we had a warning from Walmart, the US retailer supermarket, that, you know, they were concerned about the outlook for their sales due to a weaker consumer. And interestingly, we've seen the markets react to the data. We've got the dollar is trading around 0.4% lower. The S&P 500 is down around 0.8%.
Yeah, and the NASDAQ also down lower as well. So clearly a number that we weren't quite expecting, slightly worse than we were expecting. Fiona, stay with us. To the Indian subcontinent now, because for the first time in more than 50 years, Pakistan and Bangladesh have started direct government-to-government trade. The two countries were once one nation, but they split in a war in 1971. Relations have often been poor since then, but they have improved since Bangladesh's long-term prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, was ousted last year. Now the two countries have resumed state-level bilateral trade, and the first product exchange between the two? Rice. 50,000 tons of it sent from Pakistan to Bangladesh. I've been speaking to Faisal Jangir, the chairman of Pakistan's Rice Exporters Association.
So it's definitely a huge development for both the countries. At the same time, the food security for Bangladesh, there's a need for import. And Pakistan being the fourth largest exporter of rice globally, it's a significant development in terms that after a very long period of not having any trade deals between both the countries on a G2G basis, so we are now witnessing this massive amounts of rice now being supplied by Pakistan.
So this export is of 50,000 tons of rice. How much more do you expect to be exported from Pakistan to Bangladesh?
So by the end of this year, we expect the volume to go up to 800,000 tons of rice.
And how important eventually over the years do you think Bangladesh could be as a market for Pakistani rice?
Based on the current stats and the current crop size that we have, the surplus produce that Pakistan exports, this is going to be a significant amount of rice going to a single destination, because Pakistan's area under cultivation has been growing for the past years and we expect this to grow even more. So to say that we'll have larger volumes with Bangladesh is definitely what we are eyeing for.
And how important could this be for Bangladesh? Because if I understand rightly, it's been importing its rice from India and also from places far further afield than Pakistan. So how important could this be for Bangladesh?
For Bangladesh, I think right now Pakistan is the best choice. Reason being that Pakistan currently is the cheapest global supplier. So it does not strain the foreign exchange bills for Bangladesh. And at the same time, they fulfill their demand for the rice in Bangladesh. Pakistan is giving the best payment terms, and at the same time, Pakistan's also giving them the best prices. They've not been able to find cheaper rice than this as of now.
And what does this development tell us about the relationship between Bangladesh and Pakistan? Because that relationship has not always been easy since 1971 and since the war which led to partition.
Well, this is definitely a significant development, because Bangladesh was a complete dependent state on one of the neighboring countries. The need to have multiple suppliers was always there. To rely on one country was never what Bangladesh should have done. And they now rely on more suppliers than being only one country, which was happening in Bangladesh for a very long time.
And your focus, of course, is on rice. But do you think there's potential for exports of other products from Pakistan to Bangladesh in the future, and possibly exports the other way around as well, from Bangladesh to Pakistan?
So from Bangladesh, Pakistan had been importing various products. For example, I would say raw jute, which Bangladesh is the largest producer in the world. So Pakistan imported raw jute for the past good more than 40 years. We've been importing this. But now with the development of this rice, we'll not be just limited to rice. We are looking for other food products as well. For example, we're looking for yellow maize. We're looking for sesame seed, which Bangladesh has a large requirement, and Pakistan is certainly looking to develop that as well.
So a positive development all round in terms of the trade relationship between the two countries.
Yes, agreed.
Faisal Jahangir, the chairman of Pakistan's Rice Exporters Association there. Now, we're going to end the programme where we began by talking about AI, because here in the UK, more than 1,000 musicians are protesting against the government's plans to change the country's copyright laws. They include the likes of Annie Lennox, formerly of the Eurythmics, Damon Albarn from Blur, and Kate Bush. The musicians say the proposed government changes will make it easier for AI companies to plunder their work by training their models to listen to their songs and imitate them. The artists have released a symbolic silent album, literally a playlist made up mostly of silence with a few noises from the studio, saying that this is what the albums of the future will sound like if artists and their work are not protected. Former Beatle Paul McCartney is one of those who's worried, as he told my colleague Laura Koonsberg.
Just worried about the copyrights not being protected, because if it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit. And I think that takes away a lot of incentive, you know, because when we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
But Eileen Burbage, an investor in tech businesses as a venture capitalist and the founding partner of Passion Capital, says the UK government has to balance competing demands.
The question is the role for the UK to play. And I think there is a balance. And the UK government's point of view is, listen, US tech companies already do this with copyrighted materials around the world. If we were to make it more restrictive or more difficult for UK AI companies to do the same, are we not hampering our own industries at the sort of sake of other countries' right. policies? So there is a balance to be played.
Well, Fiona Sincotta is still with me. Fiona, I guess this is just another example of just how disruptive AI can be in areas and in industries that we possibly weren't even expecting it to be.
Oh, completely. I mean, it's popping up everywhere, right? You know, as we pointed out, this could be disastrous for musicians. But on the other hand, that's a really good point, that if it's being done elsewhere, then actually we're falling behind and missing a trick. So, but yeah, as you said, you know, I think that we're going to see AI appearing in a lot of industries where we won't necessarily have expected it.
And will you be rushing out to buy this symbolic silent album, a playlist made up of mostly of silence?
Well, I think I will to support the cause, because I'm behind the musicians on this one rather than the AI, I think.
Yeah, it's worth saying that the money that's raised will be going to support musicians. So there is a worthy cause behind it.
Yeah, completely. No, and I think it does support that view. You know, I am of the view that musicians come from emotions and heart. So, yeah, I'll go with it.
Thanks, Fiona, very much for joining us here on World Business Report. That's just about all we have time for. From me, Gideon Long, and from the rest of the team, have a great day.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.